4 Mac Minis.
Yeah.
Plus, it looks like a MacBook Air.
It's the Skyposaurus. We never really named that thing officially.
And one TRS-80. We don't know what it does. Nice. I know we bought it at Radio Shack. It's not clear what its purpose is, but everyone's scared to unplug it.
You can store recipes.
Radio Shack used to make computers. Now they just make remote control cars.
The trouble is that you have to store your recipe.
Batteries
too.
You have to store your recipe on a cassette tape. We are recording, right?
We are indeed recording.
This is some of the best improv.
We do not want to lose this.
Have we started yet?
We've always started.
It's usually 40 minutes in when we ask that question.
Coming to you live from the Stack Exchange headquarters in New York, New York, you're listening to podcast number 41 with special guests, Nick Craver.
Hello.
Jeff Doggis.
Hello.
Kyle Brandt.
Hello.
And those three are members of the SysAdmin team. I don't know, it's all DevOps, right? You build and you run. And here at Stack Exchange, David Fullerton, our normal host.
Yo.
Jay Hanlon.
Good afternoon.
I was just noticing that your last name, Jay, in French would just be Alon, which is pretty much all vowels.
I guess that's true. The French don't like me.
I'm your producer, Joel Spolsky, and the other producer is producer Alex.
Hi.
Joining us today remotely from our headquarters in Denver, I believe, right? Is that correct?
That is correct. I am in the Denver office sitting in the remote interviewing room.
What's it like there?
I'm looking at a brick wall, and it's sunny.
Okay.
There's a dedicated remote interviewing room. Is that past the gift wrapping room? That's that room's only purpose?
It is back by the storage closet. It's because we have a lot of people who have to take interviews here and do Skype interviews.
We do a lot of hiring.
We have a dedicated space.
Wow. We are going to hire 45 salespeople in 2013, many of them in Denver. Hey, everyone. What's up?
Jay, what's up?
Oh, so Joel,
podcast 41.
You said you had a long agenda of items you wanted to discuss with David and I.
Yes,
we're prepared to respond to any of them. Okay, David, should we talk a little bit about the data center?
Are there all these systems type people on my podcast?
So everybody's in town, or all the SysAdmins and two of the developers who do a lot of the SysAdmin stuff or stuff with the SysAdmin team are in town because we are moving our data center. We're changing facilities in New York.
Okay.
From the one that
Got flooded.
Yeah. To
one that is not flooded. It merely went off during Hurricane Sandy, but it was not actually flooded.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with why we're moving. Actually, we decided to move well before the flooding. But...
Or at least one day before the flooding, if I'm not mistaken.
No. We were planning on moving the weekend after the flood. I think, or a couple weeks after. And then
that got postponed
because everything went to...
So for those of you that are keeping track at home, we had our original data centers downtown New York. That's the one that got flooded out in Sandy, although it was up the whole time and still up, and the flooding did not actually take it down at any point in time. Although everybody thought we were about to run out of fuel, and so we shut down Fogwigs for a few hours. But most everything else stayed up, including some companies like Squarespace that were... Everybody knows this from the podcast, so I don't have to...
Yeah, I don't know why you're recapping
it. Let's just tell the whole story in chronological order.
I should.
No, we should not do that soon.
I was born...
In the beginning.
And during the hurricane, we moved, we failed over to Oregon, where we have our secondary data center for emergency backup.
Yeah, and we're still running out of there.
Data center.
But now we're moving the New York one, which we were already planning on doing Kyle, why were we planning on moving the New York data center?
We decided to move, I think it was February, so it's been a while. It was capacity.
It is almost February now.
Yes, it was basically a year ago. We were just looking at capacity planning, trying to figure out where we were in the future. We realized we need to move from individual cabinets to a cage space so we could have better interconnects, and also that we just needed to be able to add more racks than the current one would give us. So
that's true. So the data center we're at, which is, by the way, Pier 1, which is fine, but it's small, and it didn't have a cage available for us at the time. Although, boy, now that Sandy sure did sweep a lot of their customers out of there, didn't they? So there's a cage there now if we want it. But they never had enough power. And when you get a bunch of racks from them, a bunch of separate racks, for some reason, it's hard to interconnect them, which blows my mind. Why is it so complicated just to put a 100 gigabit Ethernet cable and just like physically drag it from one rack to the next?
You need more cables than that. And the hole is pretty small. So you would just need to run them up and you run through space. They probably would have... worked it out for us, but as you start to add racks, it just gets messier and messier.
Didn't we also have, I know Fog Creek has a lot of empty space in their racks because they don't have enough power.
Yeah, the new data center, before we have, power is amps times volts, and we have current times voltage. We have 120 there, and we have 208.30 here, so we have significantly more power. Now we can really fill up the PDUs with all the plugs, redundant power and everything, and we don't really have to worry about blowing out one of them if the other one fails.
Because what we had before was each rack had like a PDU, two PDUs with 20 amps each or something.
Yeah, and you're only supposed to use about 80% of a single PDU, and a lot of these have two power supplies. So if you lose one, all that power is going to switch over to the other one.
Right.
And then you can overload that one, you lose them both, and you're...
Yeah. So dead. It's sort of like, hey, we got redundancy, but each one is can only handle two-thirds of the total load. So, I heard a Boeing 747 can fly on one jet engine. It only has one of the four engines. It can still fly. Although it can't take off, I think.
Good thing our servers don't fly.
Yeah.
Yet.
Everybody thought that joke at the same time. What are we? So now we're trying to move. What's involved in that?
We hired movers to do all the de-racking, putting in a truck and getting it there.
Yeah.
So we laid everything out, and then it comes down to wiring it all up, which is an incredible amount of work. And actually, Nick is probably the best person to talk about wiring because he is incredibly neat. You'll see pictures. We'll have a blog post of everything that he's wired up, and it really looks beautiful. And it's important because you can pull the wrong things when everything isn't labeled carefully. Right. And also when things look good, you just get that sense of craftsmanship. So
there are sysadmins are in general as a class, rather obsessive compulsive about
anal. So what you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. About the exact length of particular wires.
It's all color coded. You should see it.
What is color coded?
It's color coded, and there's a label.
Excuse me, I'd like to point out if you've seen the Pier 1 racks, you would know that our sysadmins are not that anal about wiring until now.
This is a new thing.
Well, once you've had enough.
But now, wait a minute. Did you make your own cables?
No. I did.
That means you were limited.
Oh, there are some, yes, but not most of them.
Okay. What I discovered is if you don't make your own cables, then you're limited to multiples of 1 foot.
More than that for color coding. We can only get like sevens and nines in most colors, for example.
So what if you need 6.2 inches?
We do have custom colors of every cable. So we can make them, but they're a little stiffer and a little harder to deal with. So we go with what we can if it fits.
And then you just have a little piece of, but what do you do with the extra 8 inches of cable? It's got to go somewhere, right? So
there's some horizontal cable management on these racks, and vertically everything's very neat. So everything exposed is very neat, and then internally it's coiled, or not coiled, just loops inside over top the longest ones. So it's easy to add and remove a server, even though it's coiled in there.
Did you get those extendo arms on the back so that you can slide the server forward while the nylon cable is coming?
And they are a pain in the butt. They're worth it, but there's nine cables in our 1U arms. So
for some reason I started with those. And they were just totally not worth it. Like the number of times you actually could then slide out a server to do something to it was so little compared to the pain of routing the cables through those dumb little arms.
It's initial pain versus future pain. We have a lot of upgrades because we're changing things a lot. And the main thing is George likes them, and he's the main person going there. So the person that goes there and does it gets to decide how they want it.
Apparently not on this podcast. So we can just blame him.
Yes, George's going to camp out.
All right, George. Okay.
We've got all sorts of people around and underfoot this week who normally aren't here. They flew in from all over the country
to work on the
new data center.
And what's the plan now? We're just going to fail back over?
Yes, it'll be a couple weeks. We've had issues with, you'll see the people using our site will see a yellow screen of death. Not even a nice cat error page, just a straight up. It's like a blue screen of death from Windows. It just says runtime error / for Stack Overflow. We've thrown that a little while lately.
Wow.
And that's due to Windows clustering being buggy, really, really buggy.
Okay, wait, so, Windows clustering or SQL Server clustering, or is it the same thing?
On SQL clustering is built on top of Windows clustering. So when we boot a server in New York or shut it down for patches, either direction, Stack Overflow goes offline for a couple minutes when it comes back up.
Isn't the whole point of clustering that doesn't happen?
Yeah, you would think.
But
our low availability model is not working well.
Low availability model? Are we talking about Joel's plan to go out for a day, or at least until the Wall Street Journal reports that all programming on the planet Earth is stopped because Stack Overflow is out?
If we don't do anything right now, the transaction logs are backing up in Oregon waiting to disperse to the SQL servers in New York that aren't on yet. So if we just don't touch it, you know. About a week, about four or five days.
Wait, why haven't they been backing up since Sandy?
They've New York has been on in Pier 1, just dark-ish.
Oh, interesting. So they haven't actually, like, the SQL server in New York has been up.
Yes.
And they've been, the clustering has been flowing. Mm-hmm. But just during the move, we were down for a few days.
Yeah, so we've done it for about 4 or 5 days. And actually, I have a timer in my pocket.
So now somewhere there's some code that somebody at Microsoft wrote that basically says in a loop, in an inner loop somewhere, copy, you know, all the transaction logs that haven't been received. And they just go unresponsive while it's happening?
They don't go unresponsive. It's asynchronous. So every single thing you do to the SQL Server that's active, it disperses that a copy of that transaction to all the other ones. So it just kind of queues up and as bandwidth allows, goes to the other side. It's not very efficient because it just replicates to every node.
Right.
So we're in Oregon, it actually streams the same data to both of the New York nodes. So we use twice the amount of bandwidth.
Oh, I mean,
not a huge concern, but
okay. Because it's not like it sends it one to New York and then just, well, why don't you turn on one in New York and then turn on the other?
That will crash it as well. It used to be about a 30% chance of this happening. Yeah. We've changed something that it's 100% now. So that's fun.
This almost sounds like, why do you then want the high availability solution if in the one instance where you actually need high availability?
Turns out we don't.
Yeah. Okay.
So at Microsoft, we have our contacts at Microsoft, we have the clustering team, we have the SQL team, we have the like the Windows clustering team. The guys who wrote it are saying, it's buggy. Go to 2012, which is what we made the call to do this afternoon.
2008. Okay, so we're going to, that's great. Wait a minute. So that means that we need to port to 2012 in Oregon first.
No. So what we'll do is we'll destroy the cluster in Oregon. Steve and I will do that tonight. Hopefully no outages, but it might be down for a few minutes. So we'll do it after hours.
Uh-huh.
We'll destroy the cluster on the New York side. And then we will have one SQL server up in New York on 2008 as an emergency. If Oregon goes south, we can restore backup and get the sites back on with a little bit of data loss.
Yeah.
And then we'll be upgrading the other box, the second one in New York, to 2012. We'll wipe it and install 2012. Get it all fully stable.
Low-level format. Format slash whatever.
Our ultra-secure voting. So once we get that up and running, we'll do a read-only test. Probably even during peak to make sure 2012 is good, handling the load and everything. And once that's up, we'll destroy the other 2008 cluster, the member in New York. We'll make it part of the 2012 cluster. We'll do another test. And then if that's successful, then we will take full backups from Oregon, restore them in New York. And then right before the failover, we'll cut the sites off in Oregon, restore the differentials, just a little bit of data that's changed since the backup. And then we'll go live in New York.
If you make a cluster, so you might have said this and I missed how this works, but if you're creating a cluster for the first time, in one side of the cluster is in Oregon, one side of the cluster is in New York, isn't there some point at which you have to transmit the entire database?
Yes.
Across? What if you already have the database on the other side? Is there some manual way you can say, mm-hmm. wait, you already have it?
Yes, you can restore the databases manually and leave them in restoring mode. And then what will happen is the database in New York...
Okay.
If it knows the replica is going to be online, you tell it that I'm going to restore the database server that already got it, and then it will hold every transaction after that point, and then it will have that ready to go as soon as that restore is complete, and it will take over finishing the job and getting it up to date.
Which hopefully won't take more than 3 or 4 days with everything not responsive during those 3 or 4 days.
We'll show our power to the world.
And hopefully the Wall Street Journal writes about it. Okay.
We're going to move fast and break things.
Wait.
We're going to definitely break things.
That's Facebook. Did I ever say that?
Yeah, you told us to do that.
We can break just Facebook. That's Stack Overflow.
Damn. Well, it worked for Twitter. What else is on the agenda, Jay?
What else is on the agenda, Joel? Should we talk about the Quick Start Guide?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, talk about the new About page. So we rolled out this new About page, which is really more of a Quick Start Guide to... it's on most sites now. I don't think it's turned on Stack Overflow, but...
It is.
It is on. It's on everywhere then. Just go to stackoverflow.com/about.
Quite everywhere? Is it? Is it everywhere?
Maybe not quite everywhere.
It's many of our sites.
Almost all places. I think all the parent sites. It's on Stack Overflow now.
Okay, cool. So you go to the site and you go to /about. How does anybody, normally do people find this because either they go there not logged on.
So no one's ever found it before. One of the things what we haven't really done yet is we're in the process of designing a little bit more of a natural path so that new users are kind of sent there.
Mm-hmm.
I think initially by Dane of the communications they get in the sign up process, we'll be kind of saying you should start by reading the About guide to get a feel for kind of how we're different. And then ultimately we'll probably be sending unrecognized people there who land on the main page as opposed to an individual question. We'll be kind of nudging them there, I think, with a bar or something of the sort.
So right now, actually, if you go not logged in, you get a hello world in the top right-hand corner.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be for new users. And that goes to About. And then it does say About in the top thing. But once you get logged on, it starts to disappear and it's harder and harder to find. But it is the first link at the bottom of the page. Wow, along with 47 little multicolored.
Yeah, so for all the people who are reading every link at the bottom of the page, it's very easy to locate.
Yeah, a lot of people. A lot of people look there.
Right next to Find a Stack Exchange store, I think, is where we've put it right now. But
no, we got rid of the store. It's closed.
No, I mean our physical, our brick and mortar location.
Oh, right. Yeah, the store locator.
The pop-up, the truck that roams the city selling.
Special instructions for people in South Korea.
Fajitas. But I think the what's interesting, I think, a little bit is this is a new thing, right? So we haven't had anything like this. We obviously had an FAQ, and what this is, and we've spent an embarrassing amount of time doing this, but we're really trying to distill out the absolute minimum that a new user needs to understand to have a good initial start on the site. And it's sort of, it's one of the things designed to help two groups that sometimes can feel a little bit in opposition, right? So we want new users to know enough to be more comfortable, more likely to kind of fit in and follow the rules and the conventions that are a little different here.
Right.
And we want experienced users to have a more positive first interaction with new users so they are incentivized to be nicer to them. And I think in the past, one of the challenges, and actually we got a lot of really, really great feedback. This has been distilled down to kind of this nice, easier to read, kind of pretty short list of things you need to know. And one of the questions we got was sort of, it's pretty, it's nice. What do you need it for, right? This was all in the FAQ, right? This is kind of covered. Yeah. And I think that my view of that is it's sort of like, well, what do you think Grandpa's going to read the Post for, right? He's had that 6-volume history of the world on his shelf for many, many years, and he's never chosen to read that.
Yeah.
It covers every day, not just yesterday. And we really wanted to get to here, right? This is a more consumable.
I don't understand the grandpa metaphor at all, but that's okay.
Well, you see, my grandpa, he never. But so anyway, we've had, I think,
he's got a 6-volume history of the world.
You see, because it.
Let me put it in a non-metaphor. People come to Stack Overflow.
Could it be
any Stack Exchange site? And they don't get that this is Q&A, not discussion. Because all they've seen on the internet is discussion sites. And we have to explain to them, no, this is people asking questions and giving answers. We're not just here to chit-chat. That's the most important number one thing. And then there's voting and some other stuff. But there's a few ways in which it's just so different than other sites. But you don't see that. It's not immediately apparent that chit-chat is not welcome.
That's right. And I think one of the things also we struggled a bit with is we're going to have to push people to get to it in the first place. But one of the reasons we focused a lot on trying to make it interactive is the wrong word, but make it a little bit prettier than just a kind of block of text and keep it short, is even if you can articulate to someone very quickly that you're a little bit different, people don't, you know, we talk about people getting, you know, we have low tolerance for the kind of RTFM, you know, read the effing manual feedback. But what's important behind sort of just wanting to be polite is also that people don't believe when they go to the internet, they're going to need a lesson to use it. They don't think typing in a box requires them to first learn things. And so what we're trying to get to is sort of this very short, very concise, starting with sort of things are a little different here. And here are the very few things you need to understand to probably have a pretty good start going forward. And then the hope is that will then give them enough to then go use the site, right? I think, you know, we think the best tutorial is actually participating, but people that try to jump right in, like you said, treat it a lot like a discussion board and have often unpleasant experiences.
Cool. And it's all animated. What's that about?
Well, everyone loves that. There's been a request for more animation, maybe a zoom in kind of.
The point of the animation, I'm willing to answer that actually, since I was the one that pushed for there to be animation, and everybody was like, "Can we just skip the animation?"
That's true.
Like, no, there must be animation.
That was 3/4 of the time spent was arguing about animation,
and like 5 minutes actually implementing it once it was decided.
The implementation at the end of this was like days. the arguing over what should be in it and what it should look like was weeks
David,
months.
You and I should have recorded sessions of us sitting there watching things slide in and debating how quickly they should actually slide.
Yeah, it was an embarrassing amount of time.
So the point is that there's a tendency to do this with videos. And every Web 2.0 website has on the homepage a video with a little, like that little shaky hand-drawn animation with little stick figures doing, you know, using the app or doing it the way before we had the app, we had to walk to the fax machine and all that kind of stuff. And
what app is that exactly?
I don't know. But every site has one of those like, little animations. Yeah. And you don't want to sit there and watch it because then you're sitting there with your hands in your lap for like 5 minutes while you are forced to go through this animation or video at the animation/video speed, which is very frustrating when you're on the net and you're used to being able to control the speed at which you experience things and speed forward and speed backwards and go back and forward and basically choose your own speed. So video is a very frustrating part of the internet's experience. So we want it to be text, not video.
But, yeah, because video on the internet's not going anywhere.
It's never going to work.
It's doomed.
It's doomed.
Nobody wants to watch videos on the internet.
Hey, I subscribe to YouTube.
What? Why?
You can get videos.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that like one of those things where they like email you a funny video every
day? No. You go, like you watch a certain video, and then sometimes they're telling you to subscribe and they're pointing down.
Uh-huh,
and there's a subscribe button and you click that. Uh-huh. And then if you go to the right place in YouTube, which is hard to find, you'll be fed all future videos from this YouTuber.
Oh. We should do something like that.
Okay. Anyway, the videos are not the way to go, but reading text is boring and people would eventually give up. And so I figured if we had a little bit of animation, this was the theory, people would be kind of at least enjoying the process of scrolling down and seeing, what will happen if I continue this adventure of scrolling.
It is quite an adventure. And the biggest surprise sort of is like near the bottom, actually. When you get to the bottom, something special happens. So make sure you keep reading.
Wait, I didn't see the
one quick thing. Question. I really like it, but where did the Venn diagram?
Oh, the one that says that we're a combination of Dig, Reddit, and I don't
Wikipedia,
know,
blogs.
I admit it's a little dated.
Wikipedia.
The problem with most sites explain what they are is there's not enough set theory involved in communicating what the site is about.
So
it was not a bad way to explain it 3 years ago.
When
Dig existed?
The original about page was mostly cut and pasted from Jeff's original blog post announcing Stack Overflow in 2008. Yep. So it was ridiculously out of date. It referred to all kinds of things that were no longer true. Just saying that Stack
Overflow, the main distinction it was making was we're a site where we won't put a paywall in front of you and you'll never have to pay for answers, which was a major concern back then, right? Remember those days when you were like, man, I feel like I always have to pay for answers.
Or at least download and install.
Its goal was different too.
iPhone.
Right. It was really just trying to announce what we were and what we weren't and what we were about. And I think that's important. That's part of what the quick start guide is designed to do.
But what we aren't has changed.
It shifted. But I think also it wasn't really designed to teach you the basics. It was designed to help you understand what the goals and the purpose was. And this is a little bit more of a hybrid. Yeah. But I think an interesting observation that we got from Meta, which was a great one, was that, you know, in trying to really distill it down to this more useful thing, there were some elements of that I think users highlighted and they were right as really valuable. So there was a concept in there that really hit directly on the notion that these sites are built by you. So it's not just these powers we're describing. You can edit, you can do this, but the kind of overview, the purpose of all that is that these are community design sites. We are more democratic in a lot of ways than a lot of places. We're not, you know, unmoderated, but, and that was a concept that I think was important to people. It's important to who we are and what we do. And that got a little, that was missing. That wasn't hit directly enough.
It's
and
true.
So we re-added it. That's
do you,
back
do you
in.
Ever tell one of your friends that you try to explain about how you work for Stack Exchange and they're like, so you guys sit around writing answers to programmers?
Who do you pay to write the answers? That's what you always get, right?
Yeah, or something like that, some combination of. Isn't that a lot of work, answering programmers' questions? No, we don't actually answer them. Oh, never mind.
Yeah, it is. As soon as that comes up, you know it's not going to end well, because where you're going to end up is, so you don't really do anything, right? You're just kind of freeloading off these people.
I used to
like, we set up the site where people ask and answer each other's questions, and then you get the look. Like,
I tried to explain. Yeah. I still have relatives who are like, you still have that debugging program?
Yeah.
By which they mean FogBugs, I guess.
What's
you
that?
You guys still make FogBugs?
Yeah, it's a debugging program.
I thought you were talking about Trello.
No, Trello, I can't even explain. I can't even begin to explain what that's supposed to do.
Lists of lists.
We got some fortune cookies done up in Trello colors and with Trello fortunes mailed to the office by a fortune cookie company. It was very nice of them. Chocolate dipped fortune cookies. And they were dipped in like Trello colored chocolate. There was like blueberry chocolate. They were awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, where was this announced? Because my wife, out of the blue yesterday, was like, you need to get me a Trello fortune cookie. And I had no idea what she was talking about.
I guess you don't follow Trello on Twitter.
Yeah, there were some
at
tweets.
Trello,
sometimes.
But she does not follow Twitter at all. I was very confused.
Maybe that's what she wants you to think.
Guess so.
Does she follow Trello on Facebook? I mean, it's technically possible.
Possible.
There's no way of knowing how knowledge disseminates anymore.
It was weird.
Okay, new about page.
So that's out, yeah. And then there was one other feature that went out this week, which was the which was already on the blog, which is the upload your profile picture.
Oh yeah, that's kind of a small thing, but it's a part of that. But the principle is
we did actually talk about that. I think we covered the whys on that. I think when Jeremy was on, we talked a little bit about why we wanted to do that. But that's live. It's up.
Yeah, that's out there. So go upload a picture. But not an animated GIF, because somebody did that and then we had to make it not possible to do that.
Wait a minute. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know what you should do?
We disallow animated GIFs now.
No. That's not how Joel other things can be animated, if that's possible.
There was a complaint about this on Meta.
We should allow animated GIFs for like 3 or 4 days and then grandfather in the ones that exist. So it'll be like a very, very special thing, which is what Twitter did. There are animated GIFs. If you ever change your picture, that's it. It's gone. So once you get an animated GIF, you're sort of stuck with it.
Huh.
Or you may lose.
You know, we could do this for Winter Bash 2013.
Okay.
Or just during Winter Bash, you get to put an animated.
Or just like maybe whenever it's Friday the 13th, you have the ability to upload an animated GIF.
Yeah,
we can do this on
idea.
Any date in the distant future that you'd like, Joel. Well, we're happy to.
Yeah,
happy
to maybe 6 to 8 weeks
from now.
Don't you get a little bit of joy when you see an animated Twitter icon avatar?
No.
Programmers
are weird. You guys.
Maybe we won't do that.
Jay, we'll just, how about you? You're not a programmer.
No, I prefer those. I prefer the multicolored marching ants as a border going around.
Dancing ants.
Kind of web point 0.95.
I like the marquee
ants?
Text.
Yeah, I do enjoy
scrolling
marquee,
across the screen.
Marquee.
That was always fun.
This is the first step to rapping cats. It's always gangster rapping cats.
I mean,
at
there's so many things
this.
You could do with an animated GIF. It could be the little one that we had with all the cat jumping out of the laundry, catching stuff that's thrown into the hamper.
Are you going to list all the things that can be animated? Because
until you give me something better to talk about, you have got the secret list of what we're allowed to talk about on the podcast.
My word.
Otherwise,
okay.
I'm just going to go on and on. It's a part of our general trend, though. No, this is good to try to polish off some of the parts of the Stack Exchange experience that have kind of rusted and that we never pay attention to because they're all kind of new user things. Or, you know, once you've been a user for 3 or 4 years, you don't notice any of this stuff.
Well, yeah, because you set your avatar once, especially stuff like that. You just never,
you
never do that.
Have you seen what is on the user page? Oh, my God. Summary, answers, questions, tags, badges, favorites, bounties, reputation, activity, responses, votes.
There's a lot of things that go on
edit,
the site.
Prefs, flares, apps, my logins, network profile, mod.
It is not new information to us that the profile page is perhaps, at least the main page, a little cluttered and needs some work to be more accessible to the average.
It just got a whole overview.
Yeah, but I think the profile page is a good example, I think, of something that was designed for our power users, and it serves them well, and it does a good job of letting them access everything they want. What we need, I think, is those capabilities behind a much more simplified version that will be meaningful and useful to someone who's likely to understand and care about three of those things.
To see a number of like super simple versions of Stack Exchange showing up, where they basically, somebody who has designed a Q&A type site or a forum has, let me try to find some of these, has adopted like one or two of the principles from Stack Exchange and Stack Overflow, because everybody knows them now. So there's voting, tags, et cetera. One is the little Q&A that happens on Khan Academy CS curriculum. Have you all seen that? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Khan Academy CS. So you got to get to Khan Academy /CS. Yeah. And if you go in there and you work on one of the little problems, I'm just going to make sure that this is still true. Maybe it's not true anymore.
There's a community questions link on the side.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We'll find a link and put it in the show notes. And, they have a little bit of voting, but that's it. I mean, it's not like the whole Stack Exchange experience. There's just a tiny little bit of voting. There's another one I saw. I'll link to it also in the show notes. Here it is. It's a veterans Q&A. So it's a site called advisornet.org. acp-advisornet, that is the weirdest URL ever, acp-advisornet.org. And it's a site where people that are veterans or people getting out of the military can ask about transitioning to civilian life and get answers from either other veterans or sort of mentors from civilian life. And I noticed that they've got sorting. They have likes, so you can upvote answers, but you can't downvote answers. And they have tags. So they've actually copied like the absolute minimum number of things from Stack Exchange
to help veterans adjust. We should sue them anyway. We should sue them.
Let's do that. No. So I was thinking, sort of, they're still missing kind of a lot of the in-depth stuff that makes a great community, but they're a million times better than if they had just stuck a PHBBB on here. And so anyway, I just wanted to plug that. How do we get on this subject?
I don't know. I have
do
no idea.
Have
we wouldn't let
out?
You talk about animating things.
Yeah.
No, really, we were talking about something else.
Avatar upload.
Oh, we were talking about how messy our damn users page is because I had gotten on there when we were talking about changing the image, and it's just like a big like 747 dashboard, which is sort of fun for some people, but there is probably a lot of room for a simplified, maybe Apple-like version of the Stack Exchange experience. Maybe Apple will have to do it. Next. Moving on.
Should we talk about some of the meta questions, David?
Either that or I'm going to do an Audible ad.
Yeah, let's look at some interesting questions. So here's one from the robotics site.
Actually. Oh, we're going back to doing questions.
Yeah. Let's go to meta.robotics.stackexchange.com/Q/153. Such a low number.
Oh, good. Because is it okay to ask your opinions?
153.
I'm designing a complex robot, and I've got some ideas. Complex robot? Complex robot? How do I
just move on?
How do I? I'm designing a complicated robot, and I've got some ideas that I want to get opinions on about before beginning development. Is that okay, or should I make the question more answerable?
So this one was interesting. I mean, it was nice of this person to actually ask the question. So the question is, you know, it's this problem of on a site like this, that's really kind of a lot of the questions you want to ask, or you know, what's the best way to do this, or how should I do this? And sometimes, you know, in the past or different times, we've taken a hard line against some of that stuff, or some of our users have saying, no, it's not strictly fact-based, therefore it doesn't belong on Stack Exchange. And the moderator here actually does a good job answering this and saying, well, it kind of depends how you ask it. If you just ask, you know, what arm should I use? There's no kind of general right answer to that, right? Yeah. What arm should I use for my robot? Well, the right answer is, well, it depends.
Yeah.
But if you say, here's my situation, here are the constraints and the problem, this more specific problem is in my case, well, then that's something that we can probably answer.
Right, right. And actually, that is sort of a weird thing. So saying, what kind of arm should I use for my robot is an example of a question that demands a book in response. Essentially, like, you can ask it in one sentence, but the minimum viable answer would be, you know, pages long, because it would describe all the different types of arms that are available in all the different circumstances. You haven't really said what kind of robot you're building, or are they all making the same kind of robot here? Isn't some robots, aren't they just arms? All right, that doesn't matter.
They're all the Omnibot from 1982. That's all this site is dedicated to, is retooling Omnibots. The Omnibot 2000 is off topic. It's a whole nother...
We've been debating this internally, right? Because we've been trying to find a way to tell people more clearly and more succinctly what we mean by not constructive. Are we allowed to talk about that yet?
Sure.
Okay. So we have this not constructive close reason, which we're not very happy with, the word not constructive, because it's...
Not constructive to call someone not constructive.
Exactly. First of all, it doesn't mean that much. It basically says, your question is not constructive, meaning it's not contributing. You're not really helping by asking your question. And that's just kind of a little bit aggravating to people, but it also is not really specific enough. We're looking for ways to try to clarify to people exactly what we want them to do and what we don't want them to do on the site. And we've had this good subjective, bad subjective concept for a while. That's the title of an article by Robert, which we'll link to in the show notes. And at some point, we know that something which is very, very highly opinionated is a bad thing. It's not going to work well in our format, so to speak. Where it's sort of like, you know, who are you going to vote for? No, that's pretty highly opinionated. What camera should I get? We don't like that kind of question. But there's different reasons we don't like different types of opinions. And it's not like opinions are just wrong. We can't say opinions are bad, because indeed, all of expert question asking is getting people's opinions on what the best way to solve a particular problem might be. Their opinion might be factually correct, but it is still an opinion.
Yeah, and I think there's two axes that we found tend to trigger this. So one is the sort of very real one we're worried about, which is to say, if you ask a question where a sort of infinite number of people could produce a near infinite number of answers, and
yeah,
experts couldn't easily come to any meaningful consensus on which of them is better than the other.
Right. What can be done about shootings in schools?
Right. Is a question like that. There's too many answers,
possible
and you're not going
right.
to, we really are, it's hard to articulate this. What we're often gunning for is questions where if you took all of the most experienced expert people on this topic and put them together, they would have a meaningfully weighted opinion as to which of these answers is better. Right.
But that's a good thing. If you took the expert people, they have a meaningfully weighted.
Right. There tends to be some consensus between experts that one way is better than another.
Okay.
That things are rankable and judgeable, I think, in quality against each other.
So that's an interesting gateway. So saying something where the experts will tend to be of the same mind.
Not all the same mind, but I think that it's measurable. It's going to be meaningfully measurable.
Measurably a tendency.
Right. And so one problem is if you simply say, you know, none of these may be acceptable, but as you go from sort of what's the best phone to get, right, on our non-existent gadget site, and then you narrow it down to what's the best phone to get for someone who, you know, is not comfortable with touch screens and only wants to call, you know, 16 people. It's getting narrower.
And hates hinges.
It's right. It still stinks. But as you get to, I'm looking for a phone for my grandmother who only needs to call 911 and isn't comfortable with buttons. Now, all of a sudden, there's three phones that exist like this that are special emergent. Yeah. We might not allow that question anyway, but it's heading in the right. It depends on the site. It depends. So
it's a good effort, but we're going to close it anyway.
Like, on, I think,
but at least it's not non-constructive.
Well, but
it's too localized because it only applies to your grandma.
It's getting answerable, right? Is the
you
point?
Can't win on Stack Exchange.
But I think so. One question is really to what extent is it sort of everyone's got an opinion and none of them are really any better than anyone else's? That's the bad end of the spectrum,
right?
And the better end obviously is where you know almost everyone who really knows what they're talking about may not know all know the right answer, but they'll all know it when they see it. Most of them will agree when they see the best answer, which it is.
Right.
That's the one axis. The other axis, which I think is the sort of the confounding one, the one that can throw us off sometimes, is we've done some analysis of previously closed questions. Is things sound opinionated? And that's part of what the answer here is getting at, is kind of both those things, is, there's a challenge where someone will simply say, like, what is the best thing to do this? Mm-hmm. And if they shift their approach, because it actually, to do this might be very, very narrow and answerable, that may not get received well. You run a much higher risk of that getting closed than if you shift it to, I'm trying to implement something that will best optimize for this thing I'm trying to do. What's the best approach? It's the same question, right? It's just we found there are some trigger words and phrases where to the extent you make something sound very opinionated, it can push you a little bit down the scale, right? The actual kind of answer.
Well, we have been training our users for many years that opinions are bad. And so they will tend to, they see you apparently asking for the best or the shopping list or the poll or anything like that. Those users sort of have a well-rehearsed trigger finger that will fire.
It's also, I think it's also has something to do with kind of being an expert, right? It's that there are certain ways of asking a question that a real expert wouldn't, they just wouldn't ask that question, right? Like no robotics expert would ask, what arm should I use for my robot?
Right.
That's just like a signal that you don't know anything about robots.
Probably. Yeah, because it's too broad. Yeah, there's a lot of different guidance here. One of them is the proportionality of the... Now, there is a good answer to many of these semi-opinion questions. So you could say, what arm should I use for my robot? And you could get kind of an encyclopedia of arm choice, which would say, if you're doing this, get that. If you're doing this, do that. If you're doing this, do that. And here's how you decide. And that would be an awesome answer to this question. The person who asked that question would love it, and that would be a great thing on the internet. However, 99 out of 100 times, you don't actually provoke that answer.
Right.
So it's possible to rescue a bad question with an amazing answer.
Well, and I think that's the trick. Did we talk about that do-it-yourself question here?
Endlessly.
With the wires? We did. Okay.
No, what was the do-it? No.
So that was a good, we talked about the on startups one, I think.
The do-it-yourself question with the wires.
One of the challenges we have.
How do I diffuse a bomb? Which wire do I cut?
It's always the blue one.
There's this bomb in my house. Green wire, red wire, I don't know.
But sometimes the answer actually.
Here's a picture.
The answer actually tells us more about whether the question was too opinion-based than the question did, which is challenging. That's a problem for us, right? So we've talked before, I think, about how, like on startups, right, your canonical answer to sort of how to split up equity, I think, was one where that question might have been borderline or too opinion-based, too broad. There's a million ways to do it. Then your answer was, I think, so compelling that it no longer felt that way. Enough sucking up to you. Let's talk about the do-it-yourself one.
Let's link to that question in the show notes, too.
But someone asked a question on do-it-yourself, basically. Oh, no, I'm sorry, on English. It was on English. And the question was essentially, I'm describing wires, and the wires are, you know, yellow and black, yellow and blue, yellow and red. Should I call them yellow, black, or black, yellow? And people obviously wrote, this isn't a real question. There's no answer to that. Who cares? This isn't about English. There's no right way or wrong way. This is actually silly.
But that's not true.
Well, you're right. It was initially
very specific adjective ordering in English.
Well, not between two colors, I don't believe.
Well, there's a reason to be confused by that. If you're in English, you learn. You always say a big blue ball, and you never say a blue big ball.
No, but okay.
Always.
Correct that we can understand why someone might think there is a difference.
Yeah, it's a totally
and you
question.
Could argue the answer is there is no difference, and it's just kind of a mediocre question that is answerable. But it actually is a better question than that, because the answer that they got, because the person explained they were writing a manual, the answer they got was, you need to lead with black and blue and red and not yellow. Because you're describing to people which wire they're using. And so the variable that is changing is the relevant one. And so the yellow is actually not really meaningful. It's an add-on. It's the other word that is conveying which wire it is. And so there's actually a very compelling right answer that elevated the question. The question was a better question than it appeared once you saw that there actually is an approach that's significantly better than what seemed to be a completely, it seemed irrelevant.
I think it was a good question to begin with.
Okay. But it got better. And I think, you know, one of the things you mentioned training our users, and I think as we've been investigating these closed questions and looking at some of what happens, we had some interesting observation. I think two localized, maybe a more interesting one to talk about that had some real challenges.
Yeah. But now, when you say training, just to make it clear, this is not like having a class where our users go and they learn something. This is more like conditioning our users.
We give them a treat.
It's like dogs. Yeah. Exactly. It's like you just shout words at them until they randomly do the thing you want.
Exactly.
And then you give them a treat. And then they start thinking, okay, it must have been that thing I just did.
You need a little randomness. Like once a year, we hit John Skeet on the nose with a newspaper just to keep him working for it.
Yeah.
Somebody told me Taco was a very well-behaved dog yesterday on the street. I couldn't stop laughing. He's like, oh, have you trained him to heel? I'm like, no, he's a terrible dog. I pull him half the time. I have to pull him. It just turns out for the block that she was following me, he was being good. So training.
So we've been
too localized.
We've been looking hard at our close reasons and ways we can make them clearer. We can give more better feedback. We want users to understand better when something is closed, why it was closed, and what they could do to fix it, or in theory, what they would not ask next time.
So wait, before you go to too localized, we did touch on not constructive, and we're going to work on that, right?
Yeah, so we're in the process of really, what we're trying to do is really take all the reasons we close questions that we still believe in, which is pretty much all of them. The fundamental reasons we created these close reasons are still hold. We want to close questions that don't belong here. But what we're trying to do is rebucket them so that the label and the feedback that people get actually clearly teaches them in most cases that when you get it, you may not like it, you may not agree, but you will know what the community wanted you to do instead.
Yeah.
It or not. And that's really the key goal.
It's just a matter of explaining ourselves better. Not constructive and too localized are examples of things that either don't mean what the word means, or like to somebody from outside a community, they just like, what?
Uh-huh. Right. Not a real question is another one that just, the title is both hurtful and not very clear.
It's so fun to close something is not a real question.
We're changing that. So now it's,
dude, get a question. This is a question site. You need a question. It's a price of admission.
We're shifting to more of a, you don't seem to be a real user approach. We think that'll be nicer and make people.
Yeah.
We're not doing it.
Are you a spam bot? Close reason.
So we've basically been running through old closed questions. We've been surveying. So we actually ran through a couple of hundred closed questions. And we asked people, first employees, and now we've actually had some moderators volunteer to, we asked them for a favor to run through them. And we've been analyzing
We volunteered them.
We volunteered them, but they went along. We couldn't make them. We threatened them. we took the biscuits away. But
yeah, there's free biscuits for moderators. I don't know if people realize
you haven't gotten your biscuit shipment. We ran the internal one. We finished that one. And what we were really looking to get at really was the distribution a lot, see which closed reasons were used more often, and see if new reasons we were considering that we thought were clearer would cover everything. We discovered something else that we weren't actually really looking for, because we basically asked each person to say, do you agree this should have been closed, or should it have been left alone, or should have gotten a comment or edit? And then, because we wanted to then say, and if you thought it was closed, pick which of these new reasons you think might cover it, see if we had gaps. And one of the most interesting things, we weren't looking for this, is a much larger percent of questions that had been closed on sites and had stayed closed, were not reopened. We found that our employees, and in the initial review, the moderators also felt should not have been closed. And that we didn't expect that. That was a little bit of a surprise. Our general belief is that most questions that are closed should be. And that's actually true. Most should be. But a surprising percentage turned out to be questionable, where we looked at we separated Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange. It's very different communities and kind of maturity. But on Stack Overflow, we had two different internal people look at it, and 13% of the closed questions, both people said should not have been closed at all.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
That which is a lot. And on 39%, almost 40%, at least one person felt it shouldn't have been closed. Much higher than I thought. And these are primarily recent questions. It's not the whole universe.
One thing I tend to believe, which I've said on this podcast about a billion times, is that if somebody gets a question, comes to Stack Overflow for the first time, or Stack Exchange the first time, asks a question and gets it closed, that's enough of a negative experience that they're going to be seriously soured from the site for a long time. And
that's
true. My opinion.
We think it's true.
It's an unpleasant experience.
I believe it. We're desperate to test it. There's a little bit of a selection bias problem. Unless we'd have to arbitrarily close some people's questions to properly A/B test it, which doesn't seem right.
And then we'd have to go find them in real life.
But it is safe to say that people whose first questions are closed are much less active. Part of that could be because they had less to contribute to start with.
Yeah.
But
it's hard to separate that out. If your first question was closed, you're
Yeah.
Likely to not be a very good contributor.
Well, no, but the 13% that get questions closed wrongly then just get pissed off and say this is a snobby community full of jerks.
It doesn't take long
those exist too.
To find people you know who are smart and reasonable who've gone to the sites and had bad experiences because their first question happened to be closed and they just have this view that they're sort of not welcome there, who are clearly people we believe could add, I think.
Who we want.
Yeah. But anyway, so as we went through these numbers, I won't bother with all of them, but we did find that some closed reasons are sort of more equal than others. So two localized, if we break those out, then general reference is kind of a special case I won't play, but two localized questions, at least, 60% of the questions closed as two localized, at least somebody felt should not have been, at least one of the reviewers.
That was one of the ones where, first of all, the word is wrong. Localized means translated, you know, converted to a different locale. And so two localized doesn't even make sense because it's sort of a, you either are or you aren't. You can't be a little bit pregnant. You can't be a little bit localized. You're either localized or not.
Great programmer. This is a binary function. You're trying to solve a tertiary problem with a binary function.
The word isn't even, the phrase isn't even grammatical. And what I was actually trying to say is like this, it refers to a very, very, very specific time or place.
Yeah.
Was the original intent of that thing.
No, I think the original intent was help me fix my code.
No, I don't remember. I think the original intent was like when is you know the next version of whatever coming out, which is not going to be true. That's what Jeff always uses as example of two localized.
Two localized covers three things. I think we spent a lot of time. There's three different cases it's applied to, and I think all were somewhat intended by when it was created. So one is it refers to a situation that is deemed too narrow geographically.
Right.
Okay. So I have this problem with a computer that could only happen on the block I live on. Okay.
Right.
There's another question that is similarly too narrow, but based on time.
Yeah.
So this is would be a legitimate question, except that its answers will only be relevant for too short a period of time, whatever that
until
means.
Tomorrow. Like I'm at this conference and there's this special software they're using for the conference.
Right. And the third
and use it.
Is that it's deemed too narrow in that the answers to this question are likely to help too few people, i.e. only you or you and one or two other people like you.
Yeah, which is bizarre because we don't really have a consensus that means that you can't ask it on Stack Overflow.
That's right. And I think it's important to highlight, at the end of the day, we value questions that help many people much, much more than questions that help a few people. And we value questions that help a few people more than we value questions that help one person. But the only reason we would really want to stop questions that hurt one person is if they were overrunning the rest and getting in the way, in my opinion. And I think what we found, one, is they're not that common. It's not that big of a problem. It just doesn't happen very much. It annoys people when it does sometimes. But I think one of the challenges is, even if we agreed what the threshold is, it's got to help at least X people, it's very hard to know when it really is, which is to say that a lot of these problems are someone describing their very weird, unique situation they're trying to fix. But the fundamental thing that is the problem in it may well help other people.
Right.
And so those are hard, but more importantly, they're trivial. They're not very common. The geographic one is a good example of where we said, like, these questions appear to be closed erroneously. Two localized questions are twice as often seem to have problems.
I kept seeing this all over the place. People closed a question. It started with somebody asking a question about programming jobs in Montreal, I think. And on the ground, that's the first time I saw it.
Part of the problem was it was on the robotic sites. There was a lot of...
My robot in Montreal. Another one was, this was on server fault. It was a question about Wi-Fi standards, which they decided was too localized because, and of course it created a debate, because it applied to United States Wi-Fi standards, which don't actually apply outside of the United States where there are different Wi-Fi standards. And that was maddeningly idiotic.
But that's what we've found is if you are describing a situation and it's one of those weird ones too, where if you explain, if you add detail like we want you to, that explains that this appears to be relevant in this. I saw one yesterday that was closed as too localized because it referenced India. And I was like, 300% more people there than in the U.S.
Big
like, this
country.
This is a big chunk of the world.
Yeah.
But we've sort of trained people that if you're asking about a thing that only happens in a certain place, that's probably too localized to shut down. And the fact that that place is four continents doesn't seem to be obvious to a lot of people. And so I think that the geography one, again, the fundamental issue there is it's not that common a problem.
And this is a part of the bad training, which is that the thing that closed reason was doing was training people to look for any kind of question that mentioned a place or time.
Exactly.
And
there's
then
triggers.
Bing, ta-da! And then, they were just like, yay, I can close it. Hoorah! And that's not what we wanted.
No.
And so it was obviously creating a lot of mistakes for not a big problem.
Right. And then I think the time-limited one is interesting, and it's more complex, and I think we're still trying to get our heads around the way to think about it. But I think if we were to summarize what we really want is we want to make sure that there's a way that questions that become obsolete are marked as such. That's what we're interested in. And the challenge in the current approach is the truth is almost all questions that are asked about programming or anything else we talk about, not anything, but most of our topics are time limited, right? So people get that, you know, if you're talking about this developer, you know, beta patch on an Apple release, well, that's too localized. It'll be gone in 2 weeks when they roll it out.
Right.
Okay, but then what
but you it's get, still really important, right, this minute.
It's very helpful now.
And it's also really important that we remove it from the internet after it stops being important.
Right. And then what about a beta that goes for a year, like Siri or Google does? What about an operating system, right?
That's,
you get into this notion of everything, almost everything is going to go stale. It's almost like what we want a better way to do is to indicate when something appears to be either dead and we don't talk about it anymore, or just a historical reference. It no longer appears to be up to date. This has been deemed sort
of... We probably do want to delete those because those are actually kind of attractive nuisances in the sense that one of the things we talked about in the early days of Stack Overflow is that the problem you would have searching for a particular problem on the internet, on Google, is that Google would upvote or would raise in PageRank the oldest pages. And so if you were looking at a particular problem with a technology that is now in version 12, you would get a lot of clutter from version 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Right.
And the thing has changed since version 8, but you still got all this old clutter. And Google kept ranking the old clutter saying, oh, this is a very old site, must be prestigious. And that would be the one that would,
survivor bias for PageRank.
Kind of, yeah. You know, it's sort of the opposite. And so when certain things change, for example, you know, the use of some things change and not everybody changes right away. Things like there's now reference counting in Objective-C. And you see an awful lot of discussion about doing things the old way. And that stuff is actually a nuisance to people that are trying to do it the new way, because it will tell them to do things that they shouldn't do anymore, or that they, you know, are just distractions or are now downright wrong. So maybe having a way to close something is obsolete later, you know, after the fact, which is not insulting to the opener, but just simply flags it as obsolete.
Right. And I think if we can move towards a system that allows us to better capture things as they go out of date, what we actually will have is more sort of at the moment useful information now, and not get into this sort of weird debate of sort of how long do we have to believe something will be true for us to allow it to live right now. It's true right now.
Right.
I think generally speaking, you know, for more than a few minutes, it may be helpful to keep around if we can make sure that it's not going to be cluttering up things afterwards.
Yeah. It's not that it's bad to have. I mean, there are certain, some of that stuff stays around forever, with programming languages especially. Like, I think there's still people that are maintaining Visual Basic 6.0 code, and that's a 12-year-old. That's a language that hasn't been updated for 12 years now, and the code could be 20 years old. But they're updating it, and they, you know, they need to make some tweaks, and the compiler still runs, and it still generates code that runs, and, you know, you're not going to rewrite, you know, an old app. And so that there are still people working on that. And honestly, in languages that are basically of that age or earlier, we don't even have a great archive of that. You kind of have to go to Experts Exchange or something to get the answers to some of those questions. They're still valuable.
Right. I think we
kind of a back catalog.
We want to differentiate between, gaming brought up a great example of a thing that's really dead, which is they said, what about when games issue a patch and they can't, you know, those things don't exist anymore. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Someone might have the old version.
No.
But they're talking about like morgues, right? Where you've got like World of Warcraft changes
the
system to
Facebook
rebalance.
The Facebook API just changes. And then there's things that you can no longer do with the Facebook API. And it's like that code does not run.
Right. That stuff could actually legitimately be deleted, I think, reasonably, because it no longer is relevant to anyone on the planet.
Yeah. We might get subpoenaed. Who knows?
That's true.
We should put it in the Library of Congress and then delete it.
We will put it somewhere safe, like the box.
So, okay. So too localized is misused, and I feel like there's a coda coming. There's a conclusion to this.
So, well, I think what we should do is we've got a whole lot of things where we spent a lot of time looking at a lot of ways we can tweak and improve the closing system to really keep what it's supposed to do,
right,
but eliminate a lot of the pain points and the nasty stuff that is both frustrating for people emotionally and also doesn't teach them what we're trying to teach them.
Right.
And I think what may make sense, we'll be ready at our next podcast probably to talk about announcing a couple of the things that are specific changes that we think are rolling out that we're already starting to work on, and there'll be a couple more coming after that. But the high level, I think, from this is we're definitely looking at the bucketing and these reasons. And I think we're pretty close to having a good proposal for the ways we're going to sort of reposition, rename a lot of these and move around so that the information the users are getting teaches them something.
Are we still going to, we talked internally about the idea between distinguishing between a closed reason where we're closing your question because it's kind of irredeemable, like, please don't ask that here, and a closed reason where you probably just need to fix your question, and then maybe you can ask it.
So we're doing a bunch of stuff around that, both the kind of way it's positioned and also what it means. So one of the things that we learned is both in the way our system actually worked and in the message people heard. Closed seemed to mean you have been shut down, you're not welcome here, and we don't want to talk about this any further. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, it didn't say that, right? There was feedback that actually said, go read more here, but the front message was closed. Closed.
Actually, it actually told you, go read the FAQ. And then when you went to the FAQ said, go read the FAQ for more information.
Wait, the FAQ said, go read the FAQ?
Yeah, it was this weird thing where we were like, copy-pasted some code. So the FAQ itself just said, go check out the FAQ for more information.
Yeah. There was like kind of a lot of random posts to blog posts. It was very hard to track down the information you needed to figure out why you were being shut down.
So the problem was when you tell someone they're closed, their initial reaction is not, well, gosh, what can I learn from that? What could I have done differently?
Yeah.
They go, why? I shouldn't be closed. This is a good question. Right. It makes people want to debate is one problem. And the second problem was even people, forget the emotional response, people that did behave constructively. So they go, they get it. They happen to not have gotten upset. They understand, or they go read the FAQ, referring them to the FAQ, and somehow they figure out what they're supposed to do. There wasn't a great way for those questions actually to get a second chance. Mm-hmm. A bunch of people have already decided they should be closed. If someone does actually go and improve it or fix it, or just even disagrees respectfully, I think it was misinterpreted, there wasn't a lot to save them. So we have a reopen queue for a while now, since I think the summer. But the problem with the reopen queue historically has been things don't get into that unless someone happens to stumble upon it, read a closed question, and decide they disagree and mark it for reopening. And then the reopen queue shows other people, do you agree? So there's a couple of things going on. So one is we're looking at shifting the headings around these to give a better message back to the original user that we've now showing you what you would need to do to fix this. We're being much more specific, hopefully, and saying if this were narrowed down to an answerable amount, if this were had additional details, we could understand exactly what's wrong. We could probably help you. The question is not going to say close. They argue we're looking at titles that are more along the lines of on hold, where it basically says, hey, we actually need you to make an update here so we can help you. And the difference
your question
is
instead of can't be answered until
right. So it's no longer saying you've been shut down and here's why. It's saying we need another action from you to move this forward and help you. You're actually still in the forward motion process as opposed to having crashed into a wall and being debating the wreckage.
Although really, you've been crashed into a wall at this point.
Many of them will crash into the wall eventually.
There is a certain tendency to type a question into Stack Overflow and then kind of ignore it. Some people have. You're just sort of not paying any attention, not responding to anybody. Just kind of, if they get an answer, they're happy. But if they get just further question follow-ups, comments saying, can you follow up? There is a bizarre
tendency. They found their answer, or they've moved on, or they've forgotten, or they're lazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the communication will be much more along the lines of, hey, there's a next step now. We need you to do something. And then the other thing that we're adding is, there will be a trigger. So now if someone does go in and improve their question, people go in and edit, that will proactively push it into
a review queue,
the reopen review queue. So by simply improving making an effort to improve your question, people will then proactively have it put in front of them to say, hey, this thing's been improved. Can we reopen it now? Does it look better? And that'll create a real kind of path for questions that are savable to be saved. And we don't think that'll save most closed questions, but actually the people who are most frustrated, who actually had a good question to ask and had a very kind of negative experience, I think were the ones we do value and could really add to the site.
Does this exist yet, this reopen queue, or is this a new thing?
Actually, that part already exists. So the reopen queue existed for a while.
Right now, but it's when something has received one reopen vote.
We already did the part where if it gets edited by the original asker after it got closed, you get thrown into the reopen queue, and we ask people, "Hey, should this be reopened?" And if they say no, then it goes away. But
there's not
they say
a
yes, then it gets reopened
in that queue. Actually, so
it just gets cleared really fast. But it's not very much.
You will actually get reviewed.
The volume is really low. And we looked at this before. You know, it's we don't tell you to edit it. We don't kind of indicate that this happens.
Oh,
so the number of people who
these
sort of just, you know, organically go back and decide to try editing their question to make it better is pretty low. I think it's like 20 something a week.
Leave closed. Here's a person that just went in today and just said leave closed on 96 different questions that were threatened to be reopened.
To be fair, many questions that are closed, most questions that are closed probably should be closed. But
right. I mean, it's a hugely biased sample there, right? Five people have already decided this should be closed. Therefore, it's very likely that it should be closed.
Yeah, but is this person seriously saying that? I think this person has a vendetta.
We have experience. Right?
I'm suspicious here.
A lot of these queues, some people do seem to be, and we have ways to try and catch us, but do seem to be running through and hitting the same button over and over again.
Yeah.
But to the question about, I think it's important to highlight that these queues, for the most part, get reviewed quickly, with the exception of Stack Overflow's close votes queue, which has a backlog that's slowly getting cleared out. Pretty much every queue is cleared out just about every day. These get gone through.
See, here's a good reviewer that's actually reopening stuff.
Yeah, if you look at the recent history, which only we can see, most people can't see.
Sorry, I'm just clicking through on various. Is this can moderate?
Yeah, that's secret. No,
like here's a person that on their reopen votes they reopened a few things.
Yeah,
but there's other people here that if you go through their reopen votes, it's just everything is leave closed. They just went through and clicked leave closed on a million things. They didn't reopen anything, which almost questions what you're.
They're not happy people.
These are they just do not like things being opened.
We should send them a cookie or something.
It seems like maybe there's a difference between something receives five closed votes and one reopen vote should be put in a separate queue than it receives five closed votes, got closed, and then got edited by the original user. Like the very fact that they edited it might mean we should be scrutinized in a slightly different way.
That is exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, I'm confused.
Okay, fine.
So once
I thought it just went into the same queue.
Not everything that's closed goes in the reopen queue, nor should it probably, right? So the majority on any side.
No, anything that's closed and edited goes into the reopen queue.
Yes.
But it should go into the reopen queue in a different state or with a flag saying, hey, the person edited this. Check
the edit. Yeah, we do. We say that. And it's fairly obvious because we show you a totally different view because we show you a comparison of what it looked like before and after. And
okay. To clarify, you're differentiating things that go to the reopen queue because one person clicked reopen versus things that go in because they were edited. And there is a nice, if you read it, which I think in this case, these are pretty high-end users who are using the review queue. There is a nice dialogue that basically says, this question has been edited subsequent to being closed. Please check to see if it should be reopened or something like that.
And do they get okay.
So there's I think decent communication on that, and so we didn't make a big deal about this what's going to the reopen queue because again it was a minor change kind of behind the scenes and what's feeding the queue, but we're going to look at some of that data, but it does appear at least to my anecdotal view it's not hard to go through. Your meaningful number of things are getting reopened through this process, which wasn't happening much in the reopen queue before because so little was going into it.
Okay,
but the aging tweaks as well.
Aging tweaks.
Yes. Well, you just mean on. Close votes?
Close votes, which will greatly affect the size of that queue and the monotonousness.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the close votes queue. So we've got this... the way close votes work is kind of complicated and convoluted in that they have this aging process. The original idea is once something gets a close vote, it's got 5 days to get the rest of the close votes. Otherwise, those things start aging away. A close vote only lives for 5 days. But then we have the problem where somebody would vote to close on a question that isn't getting a lot of traffic, it's kind of old, and somebody just stumbled across it, and nobody else would even see it for 5 days, and that vote would age away. So then we said, okay, well, it doesn't age until you get a certain number of views on the question, and then it starts to age. But the result of that was we end up with, now I think we're at about 60,000 questions with a close vote. So we just need to fix that, and basically we're going to just set a hard cutoff there. You get... I don't think we've decided the number of days yet, but what we're tossing around is 90 days or something. If it's had a close vote for 90 days and nobody else has bothered to vote to close it, then we just age that away and stop caring about it.
We think the behavior will change slightly. When the queue gets down to zero, then anything with a close vote is going to get more eyes immediately versus never.
Yeah, we've got this huge queue of things with close votes right now that we really need to just get rid of a lot of them.
And on that note, I think we've got a huge queue of the podcast that's been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
It's time to close it. Close it. Anything else? We got any emergencies we want to get out? Any last minute announcements?
No.
No.
Tech overflow. Hopefully not an outage in 2 hours.
Okay. Well, yeah.
By the time you hear this.
Probably up tonight.
Stack Overflow. Hopefully you didn't know this happened.
You've been listening to podcast number 41 from the Stack Exchange. Stack Overflow podcast. Remember, you can always find the show notes with links to all this awesome stuff at blog.stackexchange.com. You've been listening to me, Joel Spolsky, David Fullerton, Jay Handlin, special guests Kyle Brent, Jeff Doggis, and Nick Craver, and producer Alex.
Hey, bye.
And we'll see you next week. No, wait. Didn't we decide we're going to do this every 2 weeks?
Yes.
Yeah, we're doing it every 2 weeks. We have some good guests scheduled.
We have a guest in 2 weeks,
though.
Don't we?
We're doing it every 2 weeks, and we're going to start scheduling in some better guests than... Wait, what was wrong with the guests we had?
They were great guests. These were excellent guests.
Thank you, excellent guests.
Some of the best we've ever had, I would say.
We got a really good guest last week, and it was just because the guy was walking by while we were recording the podcast.
It is true. To be fair, our guests today were extremely sleepy because they've been pulling 16-hour days in the data center, wiring things.
Yeah.
Can we announce the guest in 2 weeks?
No.
Oh,
that's
sorry.
Not the guest Surprise. You're thinking of is not a guest in 2 weeks.
Oh.
Who is
so I'm sorry. Yeah, we will not in fact be having Bieber in 2 weeks. It's scheduled for a later date, and I'm sorry
six
I brought
to,
it up.
Six
I
didn't to 8 weeks. To... Will Wheaton.
With special guest One Direction. Okay. Bye everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Jeff and Nick have the same shirt, pants, jacket, and bags.
Twinsies. Well, we dressed warmly, and then it's hot in the data center, so these are company-sponsored outfits. Yeah.
Everyone needs to vote on who's the Arnold Schwarzenegger and who's the Danny DeVito. It's not clear at all to me, but I think we've got...
Well,
I don't know who's shorter. We're both pretty...
I don't know, but neither of us have muscles.